Next, we're beginning the 27th chapter of Isaiah. And this 27th chapter is still a part of these 24th, 25th, and 26th chapters. Still a part of this same prophecy relating to the return of the people of Judea from their Babylonian captivity. And this 27th chapter deals primarily with the captivity and the deliverance which caused the purification of the Jews. And it's really a song of praise and of honor given to the Hebrew nation that he refers to here as the vineyard. So beginning in verse 1 of chapter 27, "In that day the Lord, with his sore and great and strong sword, shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea." Now this verse is just filled to the brim with figurative language. In that day would be, of course, the time in which there was the captivity and it was ready to come to an end. The Lord, with his sore, and the word sore means hard, so with his hard and great and strong sword, for him to have a hard and great and strong sword meant that he had a sword that was most effective. It was able to carry out his will so far as violence goes. And in Psalms 12:13, I'd like to read a passage that shows how God regarded these other nations. It's not Psalms 12:13. Maybe it's Psalms 17:13. Psalms 17:13. "Arise, O Lord, disappoint him, cast him down, deliver my soul from the wicked, which is thy sword, from the men which are thy hand, O Lord, from men of the world, which have their portion in this life, and whose belly thou fillest with thy hid treasure. They are full of children, and leave the rest of their substance to their babies." What David is saying here is, to deliver my soul from the wicked, which is thy sword. I just use that scripture to illustrate that God does refer to the wicked as an instrument that he uses, that he refers to as his sword. So we're talking about the overthrow and the downfall of Babylon. So in that day, the Lord with his hard and great and strong sword, which would be, of course, the Medes and the Persians, that would be the wicked that would come in to overthrow this country, shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent. Now this word Leviathan, technically it means a twisted animal. And it can stand for such creatures as a dragon, which is a sea monster, or a crocodile. Now, there's been a lot of research into this country of Babylon and the Euphrates River to show that the crocodile was a common animal and one that was quite well recognized. And many of the Bible scholars think that this word Leviathan here refers figuratively to the crocodile, but it's really referring to the Babylonian nation. The crocodile was an animal that was vicious. It would attack man, still will. It had a very hard layer of armor on its back, so that they claimed that and I'm reading after a man who wrote in the 1830s, they claimed that a mini ball would bounce off of it. The only way you could kill one during that time was to shoot it in the belly, in the soft part. So it was a monster that was most difficult to do anything with. And what he really means here when he's talking about the Leviathan, he's talking about the kingdoms or the rulers. The word dragon is used many times for kingdoms or rulers. So he's going to use this strong and great and sore sword to punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent. And the piercing serpent is another figure. And this word piercing is not technically correct to call it piercing. It means a board that's binding something across. I never did really get the meaning of it. But this is the picture given of the Babylonian government. Even Leviathan, that crooked serpent. Now the word crooked is an accurate translation. And so he's referred to as some kind of a serpent, which we all look upon as most undesirable creatures to have to deal with. And he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. The dragon here meaning Babylon, and the sea meaning the Euphrates River. He shall slay the dragon that's in the sea. And the Euphrates River ran right through this city of Babylon. So really what he's saying in this first verse is that when the time comes, the Lord's going to use his instruments, which will be the other nations, as a sword to slay or to punish or overthrow this great Leviathan, the thing he calls the piercing serpent and the crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that's in the sea. In that day sang ye unto her a vineyard of red wine. Now the vineyard here is God's people, the people of Judea. So he's singing unto her, he's singing unto this vineyard, and the rest of this whole chapter is probably this song that goes after this second verse that he's singing to this vineyard, which is his people. Sing ye unto her in that day a vineyard of red wine. Now the authorities again say that the translation of red wine is not an accurate translation here. That the words do not really mean red wine, but they mean pleasantness or beloved. And it could be, it is translated by some as the beloved vineyard or as the pleasant vineyard. That was referring to Judea. So here's the song now to the pleasant vineyard or to the beloved vineyard of Judea. And you know, many times we have the figure of God looking upon his people as a vineyard that he is the husbandman of and that he cultivates and protects and causes to be fertile and to multiply and bring forth fruit. We today are the vine, or rather we're the branches of the vine. He's the vine, we're the branches, and we're to bring forth fruit. And verse 3, I the Lord do keep it. Speaking of the vineyard now. I do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. So God is promising these people that he is going to protect them. He's going to cause them to come out of this punishment whole and intact and a better people and still God's nation. And he's going to water it. He's going to protect it. He's going to keep it night and day. Now verse 4 is a tough verse. We have several tough verses in this chapter. Verse 4 has been interpreted several ways. He begins by saying, fury is not in me. And here's my understanding of this, and I've read from Mr. Barnes and from Mr. Clark both. They don't give the same interpretation. Fury is not in me, meaning that God is no longer angry with his people. He has punished them sufficiently. They've come through the chastisement. He still has the love for them as a father would for his child. And he's no longer angry with them. He's now wanting to protect them. He's now wanting to bring them out of this captivity. And he uses means just as powerful to bring them out as he did to get them in there. The force of a wicked nation. But then he says, who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them. I would burn them together. Now what I understand this to mean is that as he is protecting his vineyard, as he is going to water it every moment, lest any hurt it, and keep it night and day, he's going to keep the briars and the thorns out of it. And any briars or thorns or any foreign or harmful thing that got in the vineyard would really be against God, and God's going to fight against it. So he says, who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I'll go through them, I'll burn them together. I'll not allow them to hurt my vineyard anymore. That's the interpretation I get out of this verse, and it may be stretching it a little bit. Mr. Clark has quite a different interpretation. He says that this is referring to the city of Jerusalem after it's been reestablished. And these people had leaned so heavily upon other sources for protection and guidance, that is, other nations and other powers, and they did not look to God. And so here they were, a city without any protection now that they didn't lean upon God, and so they were calling for a fence of briars and thorns to come up around them and give them some kind of protection. I don't really see that in this verse nor in this context, but I just thought I'd give you the benefit of what he said that he thought it meant. But then the next verse says, "Or let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me." Now this would, if you use Mr. Clark's interpretation, it would still mean that rather than look to the nations round about them, that the Judean people should then look to God and take hold of his strength, and then make peace with God and have protection. But using the interpretation that I gave originally, which is pretty close to what Mr. Barnes says, this fifth verse is one in which God is giving the enemies an alternative. Either you can make war against me and I will burn you, I will go through you, I will devour you, or there's an alternative that even you heathen nations could take if you want to, and that is you could take hold of my strength. And this word "or" in verse 5 properly is translated "unless." I'll burn them together unless he takes hold of my strength. Now it's difficult to accurately say just what it means to take hold of his strength. This is thought to be a figure of a person going to the altar and taking hold of the horns of the altar. I don't really see that here particularly myself, but to take hold of my strength would mean that you must actively be a part of the movement that God is sponsoring, or else you're going to be an enemy of God. There's no way that you can be neutral. You've got to actively participate in God's plan, in his activities, or you've got to be actively against it. You cannot be neutral and say, "I'm going to have peace with God, I'm just not going to give him any help." You must take hold of his strength. That is, you've got to deal with God to have peace with God. It's not like somebody who has an enemy, and so he just stays hidden from the enemy, and the enemy never knows he's around, and he has peace to the extent that the enemy doesn't know he's there, and he doesn't have any conflict. We must deal with God. And the injunction here is to take hold of my strength. And if you take hold of my strength, then, he says, he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. If he takes hold of my strength, he shall make peace with me. So the only way that peace is made with God is by taking hold of his strength, actively participating in the power and in the movement that is sponsored by God. "He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root." Now here again, he's still alluding to this picture of the vineyard. Those that come of Jacob, he's going to cause them to take root. And this is speaking now of a plant that would be put into the soil and nurtured and watered. And then the plant takes root. It begins to grow. It becomes a living thing, and it's stable, and it will bring forth fruit. He's going to cause them to come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. This is just a prediction then of the return of this people to their native country. They're going to again become alive. They're going to take root there. They're going to blossom and bud and bring forth fruit. And he said they'll fill the face of the earth with their fruit, or the world with their fruit, to show the mighty spread of the Jewish religion when they did come back. And of course this did come to pass. And I wondered, as I read this, I wondered if this could not maybe be a prophecy relating to Christ, the Messiah, and the kingdom ultimately, and it may very well be. I just don't know. It's a little hard to say, but it could possibly be. As a matter of fact, I'm making a list of the prophecies of Christ in Isaiah, and I did add it to my list. 27 verse 6. So it gives us a strong thought because it could apply to the kingdom age also. Now in verse 7, hath he smitten him as he smote those that smote him? Or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? What he's doing in this verse, he's just simply asking the question, did God smite Judah like he smote those who smote Judah? Did God smite Judah like he smote Babylon? That's what he's saying. And the answer is no. Judah wasn't abolished and utterly destroyed like Babylon was. He didn't smite Judah like he smote those that smote Judah. Or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? That is, did he slay Judah like the slaughter of the Babylonians was? Answer again is no. Babylon was completely abolished. It was wiped off the globe. Whereas Judah was allowed to be revived and to come back and to flourish and to bring forth fruit and to cover the face of the world. Now we have another difficult verse here in verse 8. This